So today's shiur is part of an ongoing consciousness that we must have. And it's thinking about these boys, the Gilad, Shar, Naftali Frankel, and Ayal Yifrach. Hashem should watch over them and God should return them to their families. It's obviously an excruciatingly difficult situation for their families, for Klal Yisrael. I found it terribly painful to watch last night. Mrs. Frankel gave an interview to CNN, and she did that as a sacrifice. She sacrificed her own privacy, her own feelings, just so that she should get the word out to the international community, that people should be understanding and aware of what's going on. And it was so hard to see a mother have to talk to the media. The media, I don't want to say anything bad, God forbid, but it's not necessarily a sympathetic type of entity. They have a job to do. They report stories. But for us, this is our family. And it was so difficult to watch. And we need to constantly be thinking and have in our minds this situation. So what I wanted to share this morning is a perspective on this topic of Pidyon Shvuyim, but not... Obviously, we can't delve into all of the aspects of Pidyon Shvuyim. We would take many, many hours to discuss the various aspects of Pidyon Shvuyim. What I'd like to do is think about it in a survey, in a cursory manner, from four different perspectives. To begin with is an attitude toward Pidyon Shvuyim. And that begins on page 1 in the Medrash in Shmos Rabbah. Moshe Rabbeinu is a young man. According to the text of the Tanakh, this is at least what we know. This is the first time that he ventures out of the palace. Vayetze el echov vayar besivlosam. So Moshe Rabbeinu sees he's now exposed to the suffering of the Jewish people. And what happens? Vayar besivlosam, how vayar? What does it mean? Shehayaroe besivlosam uboche. And he would cry, Va'omer chavali aleichem, oy, miyitein musi aleichem she'in lechem melacha kashem imalechas atit. Oh, if I can only die for all of you who are suffering out there with this backbreaking labor. V'hayanosein k'seifav u'misayeya l'kol echad ve'echad mehem. He would lean his shoulder over and say, come, share your burden with me. Literally, share your burden with me. So the first attitude that we think about when we think about Pidyon Shvuyim, the whole notion of Arvus, which is way beyond the scope of today's discussion, the idea that the first reaction, if it's possible, is how can we share in that burden? Is there any way that we can lend our shoulder to help these people? So living in Skokie, maybe it's not so easy. Maybe directly it's not so possible. Maybe we should have some activist role. We should be demonstrating tomorrow. There's a demonstration downtown for those who are available. We'll be writing to our congressmen, congresswomen, whatever we can do. So that's the first thing. We have to know sink safe of umasayeh, whatever we can do. In this case, it's not so much a question of, I don't believe, it has anything to do with raising money. Oftentimes, as we'll see soon, Pidyon Shvuyim had to do with writing checks. Here it's just, you know, davening. The Gemara has an interesting discussion about a person who does biker cholim and doesn't daven for the person. So that's not a full biker cholim, because the way that we can help in some measure, the emotional doesn't always answer the way that we would want, but we have to daven. So the first thing is, we have to see, is there anything that we can practically do to help these families? But it's more than that. Because Rashi does not, in this context, quote the Medrash verbatim. Rashi takes a little bit of a different perspective on this on page 2. Rashi says on that pasuk, Vayar besivlosam, on the left-hand side, Nasan einav velibo lios meitzer aleim. What did he do? He took his eyes, he placed his eyes and his heart to be distressed over them. So you learn from this Rashi that there is a great mila, and the Sforno echoes the same thing, Nasan libo liros ba'oni echav. It's not just, well, okay, if I could do something, great, and if I can't do something... No, Rashi says there is a spiritual value, there is a moral and Torah high level of nobility to pay attention and to sympathize or even to empathize with a family, with a person who's going through a difficult time. You're right, Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't do anything, but at least he could sympathize with them. He was paying attention to them. We could take it even further. Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz on page 3, the great Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz in his Sichos Musar, this is from Tovshin Lamed Gimel, so it's early 70s, discusses a medrash about Paro's idea to annihilate the Jews. So the medrash quotes that there were some characters who were there. Eov was there, Bilam was there, and there's a discussion in the medrash about how Eov, who sat at this meeting, was silent. Paro was sitting around in his cabinet, and he said, "We have a problem, right? We've heard these words before. We have a problem, the Jewish problem." So there was a discussion. Now, obviously, this medrash isn't meant to be taken necessarily literally, because there's another Gemara Bava Basra that says Eov never lived. It's a mashal. But the concept of the medrash is trying to teach us something important. So the medrash says, well, Eov, because he sat there and he was silent, he was punished with yesurin, with suffering. And that's the book of Job. It's all about the suffering and the discussions back and forth between Eov and his friends, his contemporaries, about his terrible suffering. So Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz asks a great question. He says, why was Eov punished with suffering? What is the message that we're supposed to be taking from this story? What does the fact that Eov was quiet have anything to do with the fact that he was given the consequence of suffering, as opposed to Bilam, who was killed, etc.? So he says something interesting. He says, wait a second. You have to understand, he says, in those days, if you were in the court of the monarch, it wasn't like you had the freedom of speech to say whatever you had in your mind. Right? There wasn't type of chofesh hadibur, as they would say in Hebrew, that you didn't have the ability to say whatever you want. Really, if you didn't agree with the king, you were wise to keep your mouth shut, right? So in a certain sense, Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz says, even if Eov had wanted to dissent, that would have been a very foolish thing. So he says, nonetheless, there's something missing. What is that? He says the following. He says, Vahashosik, somebody who's quiet, I underline just this small piece. Al karchach she'ein koev lo. A person who sits with equanimity, quietly, it's not bothering him. Something's not awry, it's just he's quiet. Va'al kein bo hayesurim lahoros le'iov, ki hatsoros shel klal Yisrael lo hayu etzlo ki yesurin shelo. She'im haya margish bitzarasam k'shem shem margish hu b'yesurav haya zoik umoche af sheyodea shem macha'aso lo toil klum. You know what he should have gone home from that meeting, or even at the meeting? He should have given a krechts. He should have cried. It's not going to do anything. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether there's a utilitarian end result of your action. What kind of a person are you? Are you a person who identifies with all of the Jewish people, with Klal Yisrael? Well, if you are, then it needs to hurt you. You can't just be showsake, even if it's not going to help. You need to have a response, because that response reflects and manifests a feeling that you have of being part of Klal Yisrael. And maybe even one step further. And that's the Gemara that someone told me is today's Daf Yomi. Gemara in Tanis, Daf Yod Aleph Omer Aleph. The Gemara here is discussing what happens during a famine. So in the context of this, the Gemara is describing, let's say somebody lives in a period of a famine, he shouldn't be living a life of luxury even if he can afford it, because other people are in a difficult circumstance. Says the Gemara, Yitzayer atzmo imatzibur. He should make himself in a sense of tsar. Shekein motzinu b'Moshe Rabbeinu. We saw this about Moshe Rabbeinu. Shitziyar atzmo imatzibur. He gave himself a measure of discomfort, of pain with the community. Shenehemar videi Moshe kvedim. The hands of Moshe were heavy. When was this? In the battle with Amalek. So he's not fighting. He's sitting on a mountain watching. Vayikru even vayasimu tachta vayishev aleha. So they brought him a stone and he sat on it. Vechilohaya lo lemoshe kar achas okeses achas leishev aleha. He didn't have a chair. He didn't have a lounge chair. He didn't have a pillow. Right? He didn't have one of those special, when we go to the kids' games, they have the special chairs. You fold up, you put it down, those cloth things. He didn't have anything. Elakach, Omar Moshe, says Moshe Rabbeinu, Hoel v'Yisrael, Shiruyim Bitzar, they're suffering. Af ani yeyei mahem Bitzar. V'chol ha-Mitzar atzmo im atzibur, Zoche v'roa b'nechem atzibur. Somebody who pains themselves with the community, so they will see in the cover of the community. I know someone, when Gilad Shalit was captured, who took upon themselves a Kabbalah. This person, he used to sleep with two pillows. Always slept with two pillows. Different people have different minhagim about this. Some people have one pillow, two pillows, soft, mushy, some very hard, different drachen. Okay. When Gilad Shalit was captured, this person took upon themselves a Kabbalah that they would not sleep with two pillows. They slept with one pillow. And it went on for years. Rabbi Leibovitz, one of our Chavri HaKol, told me there was a boy in the Five Towns when Gilad Shalit was captured. He took on a Kabbalah that he wouldn't drink Coca-Cola.
Wow.
And this boy did not drink Coca-Cola until Gilad Shalit was returned. So I'm not saying we're all on that level, but the idea of Lishatif Inish Nafshe Bahadei Tzibura, that's the Gemara in Brachos, these are responses to a circumstance of Pidyon Shvuyim. We need to think about these things. Every person on their level, whether it's on the level of the Medrash of what we could do to help, whether it's on the level of Rashi that we should just pay attention, whether it means that we need to cry out, we need to krechts, we need to complain about it. You know, when you come home at the end of the day, you speak to somebody on the telephone, they ask you, how was your day? Well, maybe one of the things in the conversation is, well, there was no news from Israel today. It was very difficult. It's still part of our consciousness. And finally, for those who are, if this is part of where they're up to, where we're up to think about what does it mean, Yitzar Atzmo Matzibur? She says last night, Mrs. Frankel, that they hardly, you can imagine, they hardly sleep and they hardly eat. It's Shomu Shemayim, you can't even imagine. I can't even imagine. So, you see from this Gemara that there is an element of connection, a spiritual connection that exists, even if it has nothing to do, Moshe Rabbeinu sitting on a rock, ostensibly, you would think didn't help them. But the concept, we believe that Klal Yisrael is one seed, where that means there's a spiritual connection between all Jews. And that spiritual energy comes from the Rabbeinu Shlomo, it's mispashet, like the Bala Tanya. The Alter Rebbe said in the middle of the Tanya, it's in Perek Lamed Beis. It's easy to remember because it's the lave of the Tanya. So the Alter Rebbe says that the Jewish people are neshama achas, one soul, begufim mechulakim, in separate bodies. So how could we not feel? And that's the first thing we need to think about. Whenever we think about Pidyon Shvuyim, we need to think about it from this angle of what does it mean to us? How do we react? However, the second perspective, again, a cursory survey perspective I'd like to mention, is that if you take a step back, we will realize that, thank God, for us, the concept of Pidyon Shvuyim, of redeeming captives, is so foreign, so unusual, that we're not accustomed to talking about it. We're not accustomed to dealing with it. But if you look through Jewish history, Pidyon Shvuyim has been part of, in a certain sense, the everyday life of the Jewish community. And what I'd like to give you is a few examples, what I think are some fascinating historical examples of cases of Pidyon Shvuyim. You know, maybe one of the classic places to look is in the Gemara. So the Gemara tells a story in Chulin on page 4 Aleph. I stuck it in there. 4 Aleph of Rav Pinchas ben Yair. What does the Gemara say about Rav Pinchas ben Yair? He was a great miracle worker, a great spiritual giant. Hava ka'oza l'pinyon shvuyim. He was coming to do pinyon shvuyim. He came to a river, and the river was blocking his path, so he demanded that the river split for him for the mitzvah of pinyon shvuyim. And it did. This is the great Pinchas ben Yair. So you see, in Talmudic times, there's already discussion about Pidyon Shvuyim. But throughout many, many centuries, Pidyon Shvuyim, the concept, thank you, of redeeming captives, was Maisim B'chol Yom. So there are some absolutely astonishing and fascinating pieces of this. We could spend all day just talking about this. One of them I share with you on the next page, on page 5, which is from the Cairo Geniza. The Cairo Geniza is an amazing stash of primary documents that has been exceedingly well researched. Until not too long ago, this essay, which is published in the Journal of Jewish Studies, it's entitled Contemporary Letters on the Capture of Jerusalem by the Crusaders. And the author here describes how a ton of research has been done on the Cairo Geniza, but there were several letters that haven't been paid a tremendous amount of attention. And I gave you the whole letter in here of describing what happened in the aftermath of the Crusaders arriving in Yerushalayim. Right? The Crusades left France. There was a call for the Crusades, 1096. They arrived in Yerushalayim in 1099. On July 15th, 1099, from two directions, from the north by Godfrey and Tancred with their Lotharinthians and Flandrians, and from the south by Raymond of Toulouse with French knights. This was on July 15th, 1099, and Yerushalayim was captured. Subsequent to this, huge amounts of Jews, many of them were killed in Yerushalayim. Now, many of them were taken, and where were they sent? They were actually sent to Ashkelon. Several members, prominent members of the Jewish community in Ashkelon, went to Egypt. Now, the letter that you have in front of you does not say exactly where it was written, but the author of this article surmises, he suggests where it was written, and it was written to a great Jewish community in Egypt called Alexandria. And if you look, if you go to the end, the signatures on the letter are on page 7 in the packet, on page 175. The right of the above, the pained, sorrowful, and grieving, Yeshaya HaKohen ben Matzliach, the enlightened, and then David ben Shlomo ben something, it's rubbed out, and then Hanina ben Sur ben Ubayad. These are the three Jews living in Egypt, sending a letter to other communities. What are they asking for? What's going on? This is written the summer of 1100. And they're describing, on the bottom, back on page 5, on the right-hand side, news still reached us that among those who redeemed from the Franks and remained in Ashkelon are some in danger of dying of want. Others remained in captivity, and yet others were killed. So they're describing here, this is a fundraising letter of the dire situation of Jews, many of whom had been taken captive from Yerushalayim, are being held in Ashkelon, and are being ransomed. And there are Jewish communities in other places who are trying to raise funds here specifically in Egypt to ransom them. And then on the next page, in 172, you can read it later. It's just a fascinating document. This is an original document translated from the Cairo Geniza. In the end, all those who could be ransomed from the Franks were liberated. Only a few of them kept remained, including a boy of about 8 years old. And they describe exactly what was happening to these people and how much it costs. On the top right, on 173, the second paragraph, the community, after having dispersed about 500 dinars for the actual ransom of the individuals, for maintenance of some of them, the ransom of svarim and books, and they describe on and on the next page how much money they need. Can you please send help? We need to do the mitzvah of pidyon shvuyim. And this is going to go on for centuries. Another small excerpt of absolutely, at least to me, could be to some of you, it's very boring, but this is actual original sources. This happens time and time again. Now we're going to move away from the Sephardic lands. Let's talk Ashkenaz. So there was a very prominent, well-known Yiddish historian, writer. His name was Simon Dubnow. Dubnow was killed, I believe it was in the Riga ghetto, by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram, in 1941. But in his career, one of his works, you'll see here on page 8, was called Pinkas HaMedina. What is Pinkas HaMedina? This is an original. Again, thanks to Hebrew books, you can get, mamish, I don't have to go to the library, I don't have to leave my computer. You can get just unbelievable original works. Simon Dubnow went and researched Eastern European, Lithuanian kahilas. And every kahila in those days, they were extremely highly governed and very autonomous, and they were very organized. And they had different practices in different kahilas, and they wrote them down. So he describes here in the Pinkas on page 9, Adar Tavshin Vav. Tavshin Vav, you're talking I'm sorry, Tav Vav. Tav Tes Vav. Where are we holding? Tav Tes Vav. So that's 460 years ago. Tav Shin Ayin Dalet we're in now. So that's almost 460 years ago. What do they describe? This is in Lithuania. He's describing that in Lithuania, in our Kihilos, in Eretz Rusia. I'm in the little Os Tav Kuf Gimel. If you go down to the 1, 2, 3, I'm not going to read the whole thing because of time, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines down, in the fourth word, and there's a little dot that starts the phrase, also Haskamasena, we decided, Al Meshech Shalosh Shanim Ritzufim, for 3 years, Merosh Chodesh Nisan Haba Leinu Latova, they decided at ER for the next 3 years. What are we going to do? Lasos nedavos b'kol hakihilos v'yishuvim b'chol bate knesios achas l'shloshim yom. We're going to do this every month, once every 30 days, in every shul. Dainu tamid Shabbos shelofnei Rosh Chodesh, we call that Shabbos mevarchim. Gam l'saviv mibayis l'bayis, to go from house to house, pamachas b'shavua ligvos meis kol asher yidvenu libo. Why are we collecting these monies? For the purpose of Pidyon Shvuyim, because there are communities all over that need money because Jews are being taken captive. See, it's the world over. It's in the Mediterranean where pirates are capturing, beginning already in the 9th century, famous stories about the four captives. All the way running now, you're in the 16th century, 17th century, way off in Lithuania. There's an understanding that this is a real everyday phenomenon and need to take a Kabbalah on themselves to raise funds Bekvia, so that they should have a standing fund in the community for Pidyon Shvuyim. And maybe one of the most famous cases of Pidyon Shvuyim appears on page 10. This is an article, I forget the author, it appeared in HaMa'ayan a couple of years ago about the Maharam of Rutenberg. Rav Meir of Rothenburg was at that time in the 13th century he was the most important rabbinic figure in Ashkenazic Jewry. The most important figure. Now, he's living in Germany at the time, and there was a very severe decree, because what happens when the local princes were out of money? So what are they going to do? Tax the Jews. So then the Jews figured, what should they do? They should emigrate. So many Jews tried to leave Germany and head over, again, it's just a little trek, head over to France. Then the local noblemen realized, well, if all the Jews are going to leave, they're going to take their money. So they instituted a decree that no Jews are allowed to emigrate. During this period, in 1286, the Maharam of Rutenberg decided that he and his family, in the southern area near Lombardy, they were going to leave, persecution was going on, so they tried to escape Germany and head into France. They were able to make it, I believe, over the border into France. However, there was a Meshumad. The Meshumad is an apostate who recognized the Maharam of Rutenberg and turned him in. And he was taken by the government, and he was taken to a city called Enshishaim, where he was put in a tower, in a jail, and he was confined there. And the students of the Maharam of Rutenberg were some of the greatest luminaries of the generation, famous people like Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel, the Rosh, and many others. They wanted to ransom him in the Jewish community, and the Maharam refused. And he said that if I am ransomed, they're going to go take the next guy, and the next one, and the next one, the next one. He spent 7 years in prison until his death. He was also in a prison, in another prison called Wasserburg. It doesn't really matter for right now. On the 19th of Iyar in 1293, he died. His bones remained in captivity for another 7 years, until a man by the name of Alexander Ziskin Wimpfman from Frankfurt paid a huge amount of money for the bones of the Maharam in Rutenberg to be redeemed and buried properly. And the reward for this Alexander Ziskin was that, I believe it's still there today, although I've never been there, was, at least in the description, they say that they are still there. This Alexander Ziskin was buried next to the Maharam of Rutenberg. They were both buried in the same cemetery right next to each other as the merit. So for 7 years at the end of his life. But what was amazing is that while the Maharam of Rutenberg was in jail, he was not excommunicated, meaning he was still actually in contact with students, he was still writing and still answering tshuvas, and people would come to learn with him. One of the famous students who came to learn with him was the author of the Hagos Maimony. The Hagos Maimony himself had a terrible, tragic life. He wrote a glosses. We're going a little bit Tisha B'Av-esque here, but it's just important to keep these things in mind. It's not poshut. So the Rav Moshe HaKohen, the author of the Hagos Maimony, which is a glosses on the bottom of the Rambam, he was a prime pupil of the Maharam of Rutenberg, and he used to go visit him in the jail until 1298. Historical quiz. Who knows what happened in 1298? 1298. Close. The Rindfleisch massacres. Even, I believe, from a number standpoint, the Rindfleisch massacres in the Rhine Valley were actually worse, if I'm not mistaken, they were worse than the First Crusade in terms of actual numbers of Jews that were massacred over a period of time. And one of the Jews that was massacred was this great sage, Rav Moshe HaKohen, the author of the Hagos Maimony, the student of the Maharam of Rutenberg, who at that time was still... his bones were still sitting in the tower. Like, it's a whole nother thing. So what's amazing is that this article in a Mayan went around collecting different sources. The Maharam of Rutenberg's writings went references in his rabbinic writings to being in the jail, what that was like. So you look here on page 10 on the bottom. I only gave you a selection of the article from Mahamayan Lamed Gimel. So when he was in jail, I couldn't write this if I had all the time in the world, but when the Maharam was in jail, he wrote a pirush on Zroim and Taharos. I don't think he had any Svarim, but that's what he wrote, his commentary. Maybe he had some Svarim. So he says, Upirush Zroim, this is in his Tshuvas, Upirush Zroim v'Taharos Shali, l'kesheitze l'shalom, when I go out of here in peace, etrach beratzon sheyu mu'atakim. I would like it if we could publish these works. U'betfisasi, when I am in jail, he writes, I'm on the bottom of page 10 in the first section, U'betfisasi, when I was captive, esbori lo shachachti, I never forgot my Creator. U'betoraso v'yiraso davakti, I'm stuck with His Torah and His awe. V'hamisnadvim yechazu es Hashem benoam v'kesem paz lo yuam. Tushkat ata u'beischa b'chol pam kenefesh sar l'mashma atcha. He'ani hanishkach mikol tova, etc. Says, I'm in jail. I'm writing you this letter, but I'm still here. I haven't lost it. Maharam of Rutenberg, in his next comment, this is from that Pirush on Olos, Eid lehadvarim, these things, Sivavti vahusafti beperek migdal ha'omid ba'avir b'migdal insushaim. There is a perek in Olos that discusses the halachic status of a migdal, which means a tower or a container, that is standing in the air. So Maharam of Rutenberg, that's a play on words, he says, I wrote my pirush on Migdal HaOmid Ba'avir when I was in the Migdal, while I'm sitting in the Migdal inside Shashayim, B'yosi Tafus Shama, when I was over there. Now he's in Wasserberg, but he says, I wrote this pirush when I was in the Migdal, when I was trapped. And then the next page, you see some pieces from the Hagos Maimony, from his student, Rav Moshe Cohen. We're not going to have the time now to look at them. But these are three examples, three historical examples of the concept of Pidyon Shvuyim. The third aspect of Pidyon Shvuyim that I look at is how Chazal, how traditionally the Torah views Pidyon Shvuyim. And that is in a very unique light. Pidyon Shvuyim is treated differently than other mitzvos, and other needs, other tzedakos. The Gemara says in Bava Basra on page 12, Pidyon Shvuyim, redeeming captives, mitzvah rabahi. It is a great mitzvah. You know, the Mishnah tells us in Pirkei Avos, "Al tei mitzvah kala." Don't try to play favorites with mitzvahs. Don't say this one is important, this one's not important. But the truth is, in halacha, there are, when you have a conflict, there are certain mitzvahs that take precedence. Pikuach nefesh takes precedence to almost every other mitzvah. But this, says the Gemara, Pidyon Shvuyim also takes precedence. So Tosfos here notes that perhaps it's a Dover Pasha to the Gemara. Elsewhere, the Gemara has a discussion about selling a Sefer Torah, for learning Torah, for finding a spouse. So Tosfos says perhaps it's a Dover Pasha that you can even sell a Sefer Torah for the purpose of Pidyon Shvuyim. Because Al Pidin, Pidyon Shvuyim is called a mitzvah rabbah. It's a great mitzvah. Why is Pidyon Shvuyim a mitzvah rabbah? So the Gemara goes on to explain. The Gemara quotes The same top line of the Gemara. Amar le Rava le Rabba bar Mori. Minahal milsa de amar Rabbanan. Pinyon shvuyim mitzvah rabbi. How did the rabbis know that pinyon shvuyim is a mitzvah rabba? Amar le tichsiv. Quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyah. Vahaya, it will be. Kiyomor elecha. Ananetse. Where are we going to? Vyamar talehem. You will say to them. Ko amar Hashem. Seo says Hashem. Asher lamoves. Lamoves. Who is going to death? To death. Vasher lacherev, to the sword, lacherev. Vasher lara'av, to famine, lara'av. Vasher lashevi, lashevi. To captivity is lashevi. Va'om Reb Yochanan, kol hama'uchar b'pasuk zeh, kashe mechavero. Whichever one is later in this pasuk is worse than the previous one. Cherev kashemi mavis, the sword is worse than immediate death. Then three lines later, rav kashemi cherev, death by starvation, God forbid, is worse than death by the sword. And shvi, that's the worst. Why? Because the Gemara says, and the Medrash confirms this, dekulam isnehu bay. They have all of them. A person who is in captivity, they suffer death. They suffer the sword, they suffer starvation, they suffer everything. So the worst punishment, says the Gemara, is shvuyim. So the mitzvah of pinyon shvuyim, in a certain sense, again, I'm not saying this halachically, I'm saying in a certain sense, the Gemara is framing it as almost, perhaps greater than pikuach nefesh, because you would think, what's worse than death? The answer is, captivity is worse than death. So the Rambam says on page 13 in Hilchos Matnas Anim, in Hilchos Tzedakah, Pidyon Shvuyim Kodem Leparnasas Aniyim Velexusam. Pidyon Shvuyim comes before every other tzedakah need, including Parnasas Aniyim. Parnasas Aniyim, he means food and clothing. Ve'ein lacha mitzvah rabba kamo pidyon shvuyim. There's no greater mitzvah than pidyon shvuyim. Sheashavui harehu bechlal hareivim v'hatzimeim u'bechlal ho'arumim v'omid v'sakanas nefashos. A person who's in captivity, he has all of these needs. He's starving, he's naked, he's distressed, he's in danger of dying, of being killed. All of these. And therefore the Ram goes on and on. Ein lecha mitzvah rabba k'pinyon shvuyim. There's nothing. There's no great mitzvah like pinyon shvuyim. Came across a very fascinating article from a Bar Ilan professor, which is a Xerox of pieces of it on the next page. His name is David El Gavish, and he wrote an article called "The Freeing of Captives in the Ancient Near East and the Bible." So first, I gave you. I'm not going to take the time now. He does a survey of ancient Near Eastern texts, how they relate to captivity. And he writes, I give you a piece of the article, you can read it later. Let's go over to page 16. At the end of this whole section. To summarize, in the ancient Near East, prisoners were released for the most part when the releasing ruler had something to gain from their release, either in his relationship with the ruler of the country from which the prisoners were taken, or in the upgrading of his status in the eyes of his own countrymen and their neighbors. So you're going to have to do the research on your own, or you're going to take his word for it, because I have to tell you, I don't know anything about Mursili and Nukula Netudur of Assyria. Assyrian kings are not my cup of tea. So he says that's the backdrop on which we need to look at the Tanakh. So there are two very well-known stories directly about Pinyon Shvuyim. The first one appears on page 17, the story of Avram Avinu goes to rescue his nephew Lot from Sodom. Vayishma Avram ki nishba achiv. Avram hears that his nephew is captured, and what does he do? So he goes to battle the four kings. My friends, let's think about this for a second. Right, the four kings were dominant regional powers who had just vanquished five kings, but here comes Avram Avinu. He says, "Pidyon shvuyim." Similarly, the next page, page 18, if we had more time, we could look at each one of these in great detail. The story of David HaMelech. David HaMelech, well, he's on the run, he's on the lam from Shaul HaMelech. He comes to a place called Ziklag. And in Ziklag, they had been attacked, the camp had been attacked by Amalek. The Amalekim, who happened to be local in the area, and they took a huge number of the people there, women and children, they took them captive. Unesheim uvenayim uvenoseim nishbu. So what does David do? So first he sits on the bottom right and he cries, and then on the top left, he comes to Eviasar the Kohen. He says, what should we do? Should we try to go after them? Remember, it's like David HaMelech and his band of merry men. It's not like they have a whole army. They have whatever they have. So they come to the Ephod, they ask the Rabbona Shalom, the Master of the Universe says, go after them. And turns out, they find a starving, dying servant, and this dying Ish Eved Mitzri says, oh, my masters dropped me on the way because they thought I would die. David HaMelech says, would you tell me where they are? So the man says, sure, I'll tell you, just swear that you won't kill me and you won't return me to them. And David HaMelech finds this man, this servant, leads him to the Amalekim, and they rock him, and they return all the captives. So says Professor El Gavish on the next page. So he says, in our initial survey of ancient Near Eastern sources, we did not uncover any evidence from those sources of a war being fought for the specific purpose of freeing captives. Apparently, the individual was not considered important enough to warrant a country going to war in order to free him. Even the demand to free a captive is quite rare in the ancient Near Eastern sources. Captives were freed primarily when it suited the interests of the captor. Conversely, in the Bible, we do find evidence of fighting to free captives. These were not wars conducted by the state, but rather actions taken up by militias set up by the captives' families for this purpose. Down to the arrow. How can we explain the biblical documentation of campaigns to free captives when such documentation does not exist regarding the ancient Near East? Perhaps one may explain this against the background of the nomadic origins of the ancient Israelite community, where obligations derived from closer blood links. The biblical reports therefore relate to the earliest days of the people, and even then, it is not the state that initiated the fight to free the captives, but the captives' relatives. Meaning, there is the whole concept of family, of clan, of connection from these mishpachos, from these Jewish people. So he goes further on the next page. Besides the campaigns to free captives, we have also surveyed two cases of freeing captives at the demand of a prophet. We didn't discuss those, we don't have time. In both cases, the prophet asserted that victory over the enemy was accomplished with the help of God, and therefore it was not reasonable to keep the captives or to harm them. The listeners then acted even more generously than they had been demanded of them. Jewish tradition has developed a special sensitivity to the issue of freeing captives. While there is no specific biblical injunction that commands such sensitivity, throughout the ages of exile, persecution, and pogroms, Jews have looked back at these and other biblical passages for guidance and have assigned extreme importance to the freeing of captives by almost any means. This sensitivity has carried over to the modern state of Israel, which has acted to free captives both by force and by negotiation. So here you have what I think is another amazing angle of looking at this, of how the Tanakh, without giving us a formal instruction, says, look at these models of how we're supposed to behave. Maisa of a similar button, this is what we're supposed to look to. We view Klal Yisrael, we're all one family. Avraham Avinu, it's his nephew. David HaMelech, it's his band of merry men. For us, every Jewish person. So we have an instinctual reaction that we need to be moved for Pinyon Shvuim. So it's not like any other mitzvah. It's a unique category. So to conclude, the last section, which we could spend many days on, just a quick overview of some of the parameters, questions, contingencies, different aspects that come up when we talk about the mitzvah of Pinyon Shvuim, right? We spoke about initially our attitude, developing a moral and Torah spiritual sensitivity. We spoke a little bit about the historical context. Now we have addressed the fact that mitzvah rabbah, this great importance of Pinyon Shvuim, is in the context. So now, with all of that in mind, we need to frame a halachic response in the context of Pinyon Shvuim. So the Mishnah tells us a limiting factor. Says the Mishnah on page 21, Mishnah Gittin Mem Hayomer Aleph, Ein Podin Es HaShvuyin Yeser Al Kedei Demehen. One is not permitted to ransom captives for more than their value. Now, there's a big discussion, huge amount of halachic literature about this question of how do you measure what is kedei demehem? Is it the value of a servant? Is it the value of what Gentiles would redeem for their captives? A lot of discussion. I don't want to have that conversation right now. It's way too nuanced for this, but there's a lot of discussion about that. So what's the reason? Says the Mishnah, Mipnei Tikkun Ha'olam. Because of Tikkun Ha'olam. What does that mean? Fixing the community. Meaning there's some public policy reason why you should not spend excessive amounts, exaggerated amounts, to free captives. That's what the Mishnah says. Why? Says the Gemara, Ibayaluhu. Why is this? Haim ibn Tikkun Ha'olam. Is it Mishum? I mean, the little underline there. Mishum Duchka Ditzibura. What does Duchka Ditzibura mean? The too much expense. The pressure on the community. If the community has to raise huge, exorbitant funds, we're going to go broke. It's too much pressure on the community. O Dilma Mishum De Lo Ligarvu Velesu Tfei. So that they should not bring and grab more captives. What's the nafkamina? What's the nafkamina? Practical difference would be an individual says, I want to pony up the money. According to this first svara, look, it's not going to hit the community pocketbook, so go for it. You want to do what you want to do it. Fine. According to the second svara, it's fine. Right? You want to pay the money, but it's still going to encourage, it's going to endanger the society of Jews. You're going to encourage more kidnappings. So that's the nafkamina of this question. This, just one more parenthetical anecdote. In early 1970s, there was a rash of hijackings. Some people in this room probably remember those. So one of those planes that was hijacked, leaving Israel, carried with it the great Gaon, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, Rosh Hashiva of Chaim Berlin. And at the time, there was a big debate. Rav Shechter Shalita, he records this discussion of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's opinion on this matter in the early 70s, because there were a bunch of wealthy Talmidim, Bogrim, from Chaim Berlin, who were willing to pay a huge ransom to redeem Rav Huttner and the captives from that plane. And there became a great discussion in the literature, what is the permissibility of redeeming captives? This, again, comes up a lot, came up a few years ago in the Gilad Shalit. There's a lot of discussions about this. So how do we pass on this Shiloh? Because the Gemara doesn't seem to come to a conclusion. So the majority opinion seems to follow the Rambam, which is back in page 13. The Rambam says, and Halacha Yud Beis, Ein Poden Es HaShvuim B'Yosar HaKadei Demeim, you're not permitted to redeem captives for more than their worth. Mipnei Tikkun Ha'olam, Shelo Yihyu Ha'oivim Rodfin Achareihem Lishbosam. So that the enemies should not seek, should not pursue them to capture them. Okay, so this is one klal. There's a max. You can't go over that. However, if you look at page 22, the Gemara tells a story. And this story doesn't seem to square with what we just described. Tana Rabbanan. The rabbis learn. Ma'aseh Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya. There was a story with Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya. Shaholach lekrach gadol shebaromi. Remember, we're now talking in the period of the second Beis HaMikdash when the Romans are in charge of Eretz Yisrael and things are, they're not so good. Let's just say euphemistically. Things are not very good for the Jewish community. He went to Rome, a city in Rome. Amrulo, they said to him, Tinok echad yesh beveso asurim. There's a boy. A Tinok is literally a child. Yeah. An infant almost, a toddler. In the Beis HaSurim, incarcerated in jail, Yefei Einai V'tov Roi V'Kvutzosav V'Suduros Lo Taltalim. He's a nice-looking boy. Looks like he's put together. Holach V'Oman Al Pesach Beis HaSurim. So Rabbi Yeshua and Chananya goes to the jail, and he stands at the door. Omar. So he yells out a pasuk in Yeshaya. Mi Nosan L'Meshisa Yaakov V'Yisrael L'Bozazim. He says the first half of a pasuk in Yeshaya. All right, I'm not sure. Let's put it this way. I'm fairly confident if you stood outside my door in my office and you yelled out a half a pasuk in Yeshaya, I would not be able to finish it for you, unfortunately. Oh no, so Tinok va'omar. So the kid says, Halo Hashem zuchatanolo, v'lo'av bedrachov. The kid finished the pasuk in Yeshaya. This random pasuk, v'lo'av bedrachov holoch v'lo shama b'torasso. Omar said, Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, Muftachani bo shemora hora b'Yisrael. I know this kid is going to become a great sage. So what happened? Ha'avoda, this is a fact, he says. She'eni zaz mikan, I will not leave here. Ad she'evdenu Bekol mamon sheposkin olav. With all the money that they ask for. And, point of fact, Amru, they said, lo zaz misham ad shepita'o b'mamon harbe. He paid a huge price. And then it became Lohaya Yam Muatim Achar Rabbi Yisrael. Who was that? Umano Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. He became the famous Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, a tremendously pious and important sage in the Talmud. So wait a second. Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, he stands at the jail and he says, I'm going to pay whatever the price. How can you pay whatever the price? We just said that there's a limit. So this tension between the Mishnah on Daf Mem Hei and the Gemara, the story in the Gemara Daf Nun Ches, spawned a huge amount of discussion in the Rishonim. And what I'd like to just do briefly is survey four different approaches, three and then four, of how to resolve this distinction, this problem. And by doing that, we're going to get to start thinking in our minds, and we're not going to discuss all the permutations of, well, how do we go about thinking about Pidyon Shvuyim, practically? Hopefully it should never be Lamaisa. So turn back to the previous page, 21. I want to go to the end of Tosfos. Tosfos here, Memhei, Dimamaskol Dolo Legarvu Velaisu, says Tosfos at the end, on the left-hand side, Inami, I want to start with the second answer, Bishas Churban Habayis, at the time of the destruction of the temple, Lo Shayach Dolo Legarvu. The rationale of dissuading them of creating a disincentive is not applicable anymore. Why not? Why doesn't it apply just because it's in the time of the destruction of Beis HaMikdash? So presumably what he means is, look, the whole point is here is saying, don't shell out tons and tons of money because they're going to be incentivized to do it more. But if you're living in a period of churban, of chaos and of violence, they don't need an excuse. They're not necessarily going to be further incentivized because they're trying to do it anyway. One might make the argument that it's a period of chaos, so by you ransoming this person, it's not going to make a dent in the overall picture. So part of our mind, in the back of our mind, again, as we think about these stories in general, you know, the Shabak release that in the past several years, there have been, unfortunately, many incidents, Rahman al-Itzlan, many incidents of terrorists trying to capture soldiers and ordinary citizens in different places. So in a certain sense, one of the cheshbonos that's going on is, wait a second, when you redeem captives, are you encouraging? Or, no, they're trying to do whatever they can anyway. So by you redeeming them, you're not actually incentivizing them at all. So that's one cheshbon to keep in mind. You got to know the circumstance. You got to know the experts have to make that determination. But the concept that Tosfos is putting out here is, you're right, there is a limit. But maybe sometimes that limit doesn't apply. Maybe if the reason doesn't apply, the limit doesn't apply. That's suggestion number one. Another suggestion. The top of this Tosfos, with the previous line, I don't want to start from the beginning of the Tosis. I want to do the previous line where you see the little parentheses that says Lekama Nunches. The previous line says Lefi Shahaya Muflag Bechachma. Maybe there's another exception. When you have an exceptionally huge Talmud Chacham, a unique Torah scholar, so then maybe you break the rules. Oh, so one second. Very good. So you jump the gun. If you look at page 23, the Yam Shel Shlomo of Shlomo Luria, one of the early Achronim, in his commentary on this Gemara in Gittin, quotes the story of Marami Rutenberg, and he says, wait a minute, didn't Tosfos just say that when it's an unusual Talmud Chacham, so you break the rules? Says the Yam Shel Shlomo on 23, Shamati al Maharami Rutenberg Zal. I heard about the Maharami Rutenberg. Shohaya Tofas b'Migdal in Sashaim, Kama Shanim. He was there a few years. Vahasar Tova min Akilu Sar Godol. The local Sar, the chief, asked for a great amount of money. Vahakilu Shoyarotzim Livdoso. Velo he niach. He didn't allow it. Ki Omar ain't po den a shvuim yesterday make a day to mayhem. Wait a minute. There was no one else like the Maharam of Rothenburg. So why is this? And don't tell me it was just because of his humility. So he says, go a few lines later. I'm 6 lines from the bottom. He says the following. You know what he must have thought? If they will, then you know what they're going to start doing? They're going to go after all the rabbis. They're going to start taking each of the rabbis. And therefore, he says, it's better that I should stay in this prison than I should create that situation. And some suggest, who was the other, one of the main chief disciples of Maharam of Rothenburg? Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel. After this happened, the Rosh, he fled. He left Germany. He traveled through France and settled in Barcelona. Because some suggest he didn't want to be subject to the same fate. He was going to be next in line. So the Yamshel Shlomo says, here's his second consideration. Consideration was, number one, what's the climate? Is it going to encourage or not? Consideration number two is, what kind of person are you talking about? Here's it says the Yamshel Shlomo, but yeah, even then, even a Talmud Chacham Muflag, maybe there's a limitation there also, because you have to know the context. Answer number three, go back please, appears in both Tosfos, but go back to page 22, top line, the Tosfos there on Nunches. Tosa says the following. A different answer. Ki ika sakanas nefashos podin shvuyin yeser al kadei demayan. He says there are captives and there are captives. There are some captives who are captives, and again, keeping in mind what the context was in those days, that they used to keep people for ransom regularly, it was a business. So they're being held captive, but their life is not in immediate, clear and present danger. So those captives, you don't have the right to pay an exorbitant fee. But Tosa suggests, and this would be the third teretz to this stira, Tosa says, yeah, but if you have somebody who, Rachmana Litzlan, is literally holding by the threshold of death, they have a deadline. They say, if you don't pay the ransom by 12 noon, high noon on such and such a day, think of Entebbe, other kinds of cases. They say, Rahman al-Islam, we're going to start killing the captives now. So Tosa says, then also, all bets are off then.
That would incentivize them to start killing.
Oh, so again, I'm pointing out that obviously each one of these issues can be dealt with for hours, but these are some of the things that the Mori Hodol, the Bali Halacha, are thinking about. And then the last Ha'ara, which appears in the Gemara on page 24 in Maseches Ksubas. The Gemara says here a discussion about the responsibility for a husband to redeem him, his wife. And this is a whole complex story here about the Tanaim of a Ksuba. If a woman is captive, so the Gemara has the first opinion, Nishbeis v'hoyu mevakshin mimenu ad asara b'dameha. If the husband is being shaken down, they're shaking him down for even 10 times the value. Pam Rishona Poda. The first opinion of the Gemara is the first time he has to pay whatever it costs. Whatever it costs, even if it's 10 times. So the immediate problem with this Gemara is what? Right? It's a stira. Because we have a Mishnah that says you can't pay more than the value. Here you're telling me 10 times the value. So many Rishonim give the following answer. They say there's a difference when it comes to a spouse. We have a principle called Ishto Kagufo. Ishto Kagufo means that a person's spouse is like themselves. And the rule is that if a person themselves is in a matzava pikuach nefesh, they can do whatever they want. There's no limit to free yourself, to get yourself out of jail. The question is, what about the community? But you yourself can do whatever it takes. So Rav Shaul Yisraeli makes the following very, very interesting observation. Rav Shaul Yisraeli was the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkas Harav, the founder of the Eretz Chem de Kolol, tremendous influential Talmud Chacham, very, very well-respected sage, incredible person in the Mizrahi community. He died, I'd say, about 15, 20 years ago. So he has the following suggestion, is Tshuvas Nechavas Binyamin. So he says, when you think about, and we're not going to do it inside, I gave you two pieces of it in the last pages. He says, you think about soldiers from Tzahal, So he says, what's the pshat in Ishto Kagufo? He says, the pshat is that, and he describes this based on a whole analysis of other Rishonim, is that the person has the right to redeem themselves. So when you look at Tzal, or another example, of such a thing, he says, what happens when the soldiers go out to fight? He says, they're going as the shluchim from the Medina. And the Medina represents them. So in a certain sense, he argues that when the Medina when the State of Israel goes to rescue captives, it's in a certain sense, he says, it's akin to people rescuing themselves. Because the citizens of the state are the state. And the state represents the citizens. So he says, all right, I can't help myself. You guys, listen, look at the Lashon here. Look at the Lashon in the bottom. What page are we on here? I took it out. He says, "Val pizeh nireh shemidkudat mabatzu yesh liros es chovas hamadina bepidyon shvuy hamelchama." He's talking specifically about soldiers. Shekevan sheela yotzil milmelchama. You just think about it. We have to ingrain this in our souls. These boys go out to war. Bishlichus hamedina umitaima lahaganas ha'am hayoshiv b'tzion harei kayemes ve'omeres hischayvus. Next page. Bilti ksuva. It's not written, but is muvenes me'eleha. It is self understood. Shekol tatzdiki. Tatzdiki is a Talmudic term for any shtick, anything. Shekol tatzdiki sheish biyana medinos. And so too for to take care of their families and chas v'shalom, the fallen, etc. So I'm not discussing today, which is a whole different discussion. According to a recent article in Truman, this is a separate topic. I'm not discussing today the issue of exchanging prisoners. Rav Avadya Zecher Tzadik Levracha has in an article that he published in the Torah Shebaal Peh, a massive article on Pidyon Shvuyim, Yes, Arkadei Demeh Makom Sakona, talks about Entebbe in the 70s. This was a huge discussion in Halacha by Mori Hora after the episode with Entebbe, because they were endangering the soldiers' lives by going there. Yoni Netanyahu died. It was Pidyon Shvuyim. There were Sakonas Nefashos. There were the questions about freeing terrorists. All of these things are further complications. Some suggest that's all different. This is, we're talking money, that's talking lives. But the whole concept that I thought was so interesting is to see how the complexity of the sugya develops. The stira between these two gemaras and Gittin lend themselves to these four different interpretations, four different things to think about. Number one is, what's the matzav? Is it a matzav where we're not going to incentivize them, or fakert? Rav Schechter in his article quotes Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, says, when you're in a time of war, the laws of Pinyon Shvuyim don't apply either. What are you going to say? We're going to start paying the other army in the middle of the war? You're going to be funding their war machine. So it doesn't apply. So if Yaakov Kamenetsky suggests, in the case of Rav Huttner, as Rav Schechter quotes, he says, since 1948, as far as we know, there aren't that many countries in our neighborhood that signed peace treaties with us. So what are they? At war. We're in a state of war. Memela, the general rules of Pinyon Shvuyim don't apply to this context. The state of Israel has to govern as if they're in a state of war, an ongoing, persistent state of war. So you don't have the regular rules of Pinyon Shvuyim. So that's, you know, the concept of being in a Shas Churban Bayis. You got to know the context. Number two, you got to know the person, Talmud Chacham Muflag or not. And then there are going to be limitations there also. Maybe there's a difference between soldiers and civilians. Soldiers, there's an element of morale that's part of a Pikuach Nefesh. It's undeniable. Then the third characterization we said was pikuach nefesh, immediate or not. So you have to know every circumstance. Rachamon Litzlan. Sometimes they're being held, they're going to be taken care of, and sometimes right now we don't know. We don't know these boys. What's Ribon Shel Mashiach Rachmanos? Who knows what's happening with them? And then the last, and I think maybe Alpi Machshava, it's a beautiful idea that we have an exception for Ishto Kagufo. So Rav Shaul Yisrael is expanding this idea that we identify with these soldiers, with these people, as an extension of us and the state as an extension of them. Memela, then also perhaps you would say that the dinim of Pidyon Shvuyim are not the same, because it's a certain sense the state is an extension of its citizens, of its soldiers, and therefore it's like being poda yourself. So today we summarize some of our attitudes, some of the historical context, a little bit of the chashivas of Pidyon Shvuyim, and some of the halachic aspects, and in this merit of our learning and our davening, and are asking the Rabbono Shel Olam, the boys should be freed, v'shavu vanim l'gvulam, with them and all of the missing soldiers from Sultan Yaakov, and everyone, we should know their whereabouts. We should have shalom. Have a good day.